This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Monster Vulnerabilities.
The Confidant.
Late 80s Fantasy Film Essentials.
And Sterile Neutrinos.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom-Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom-Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near-catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the friendly confines of the Gaming Hut. And today, when we enter the Gaming Hut, we see a number of miniatures. As I mentioned, they thumped as per usual, but also there is a Monster Manual, a Monster Manual 2, a Fiend Folio 2, a Bestiary 2. Robin, this seems to be a monstrously focused Gaming Hut, thanks to beloved Patreon backer Lauberfen, who says, you mentioned special means of dispatch in a few episodes, and this seems like a great way to keep villains and monsters unique and thus expand the mystery. However, a pre-written SMD risks putting the players into a passive mode, discovering story rather than creating it. How can I offer more control of how the SMD is interpreted and used, or even what it is? Robin, if a special means of dispatch can be the friends you met along the way, is it really special?
So special means of dispatch is just a term from the game The Esoteras, as used by the sometimes somewhat bureaucratic good guys, the Ordo Veritatis, to classify everything with an acronym or a special term of jargon. And of course, what it refers to is a thing that goes way, way back in mythology and lore, which is the thing that kills the monster, that makes the extremely powerful monster who would otherwise kill you vulnerable enough that you dare fight it. So the classic example from Greek mythology is when Perseus hears that the Medusa's gaze turns people to stone and thinks, whoa, what happens if the Medusa looks at the Medusa? And he polishes up his mirror, and that's how he defeats the Medusa. So that's a classic. He's obviously a gumshoe character who's found a clue and done some deducing. But this goes all through folklore. Fairies are vulnerable to cold iron. Dragons can be blown up or sometimes pierced. You got your vampire. They have so many vulnerabilities. You can't shake a stick at them. But if you sharpen that stick, one of them is the stake.
You could make a whole game about figuring out a vampire's special means of dispatch, in fact.
Yes, and I believe you have made that game.
I have.
Yes. Silver bullets for werewolves. And it's not just within Western mythology and lore, but, you know, if somebody can think of a monster, this is an idea that somebody's thought of. So the Cherokee stone witch called the Spear Finger, the only way to kill her is to cut off the hand where she is hiding her heart. Or the Japanese ogres, the oni, you can get rid of them by hurling roasted soybeans at them, which is so much fun. There's a whole festival, the Setsubun, about it. So
the Romans had the same thing with their ghosts, the lemures, who could be gotten rid of by throwing beans at them. And they had a festival called Lemuria. So Japan and Rome together again for all time against ghosts.
Yes. So first of all, the thing that a lot of these have in common, there's the Perseus example where he thinks of a way of getting a sort of a one-off creature, right? And before monster manuals, the Greeks just thought there was one Medusa. And so that can be sort of your standard way of doing that. But in a lot of these cases, right, this is just about making it even possible to defeat a creature who would, you know, otherwise stomp you into the dirt, right?
Yeah. The, you know, classic example is in Dracula, where Van Helsing lists all the ways that Dracula is amazingly powerful. He has the strength of 20 men. He can command the elements. He can control the lesser vermin. He can do magic. He can hypnotize. He can turn super small and run through a crack in the wall. All these other things. And then he pivots to, and here's how you kill him. And he has not just the good old stake, but beheading. He has the sacred bullet fired into the coffin, one that no one seems to have used in all the Dracula movies ever since, but still it's out there. And so Van Helsing is laying out the many possible special means of dispatch, which I think goes a little way towards answering Lauberfenn's question in that maybe, as in Night's Black Agents, only one of those is the vampire's true bane, and you have to figure out which it is, or maybe any of them might work, and then you tactically adapt, you know, your player strategy to the one of those banes you think you can bring into play. So when a monster has a lot of special means of dispatch, that opens the story up a little bit more than, oh no, it's a Gorgon. We have to make a mirror and reflect at itself. That's the only way to do it. And that can seem a little rote. Although again, it's not like the story of Perseus doesn't constantly fascinate everyone from classicists to school children, even today. So it's obviously not a dead story in that sense.
Right. So the way to make that version of it, the choices version, where you have a bunch of SMDs to choose from, that's great. And the way to make the Perseus option work is the creature is new to you. It's just as Medusa was new to them, and nobody's ever thought of how to defeat it. And you might meet it the first time, and in your first encounter, where presumably mostly Game Master characters get shredded, you get a chance to spot something about it, and then you have to go off and figure out what to do. And other parts of that mystery might be, how do you get the thing that you need to destroy it with? Or do you perform, you know, a simulation with your computer to see if that will possibly work? Or find, you know, different tasks that you have to perform before you can confidently go back and confront the creature. So that gives it another possibility as well. And there may be information, you know, somebody defeated this creature in the past, and there's another one, it's back. And so the quest then is to find the person who knows how to defeat them, and there are all sorts of obstacles in the way there, or find the document.
The other way to change up something like the Medusa is to change up the Medusa. The way that, you know, when the Greeks invented the basilisk, he was originally a snake of super poison, and he later on got the petrifying glare from the Medusa. But if you're in a F-20 universe and you go after the basilisk and you're like, ah, he's got a petrifying glare, we'll use our mirror. Oh, also he exhales poison and you're going to die anyway. So the way to stop a basilisk, as the Greeks knew, is you set a weasel to kill it, because weasels are immune to basilisk poison, because everything in the world of the ancient Greeks and the world of Pliny has its own special means of dispatch. So maybe as you're going through the desolate waste around the basilisk, you see a lot of dead people with rusting mirror shields, and you think, oh, maybe this is not going to work. But sure enough, in all this desolation, no birds, no snakes, no animals, you do see some weasels just screwing around in their little weasel burrow. And maybe that is the tip you need to say, let's set a weasel on this thing. And while it's distracted, then we'll mash it with our mirror shield or something.
Right. Another point about these is that, yeah, sure, there's the occasional case where you just, you know, untie your weasel bag and sit back and watch it do its thing. But in a lot of these instances, the special means of dispatch just gives you a shot at downing the creature. It doesn't
literally in the silver bullet case.
Exactly. So you've got to actually get close enough to shoot it with your silver bullet. Or, you know, zombies, you got to get a headshot. Well, that's difficult. It's literally difficult in a lot of systems where you have to have a called shot to get it in. Or, you know, you got to get close enough to the vampire to put a stake in it. That's not easy. Or even, you know, the relatively safe seeming firing a bullet in its coffin. There may be all sorts of traps and stuff. So knowing the SMD is just step one. What else don't you know? What do you have to find out about the traps in its lair? Or just physically, what do you have to do in order to, you know, the dragon knows that you can pierce a particular spot in it. So it's going to defend that pretty aggressively. And it's a dragon. So yeah. Knowing that you can, you know, there's one particular part of its armor that is actually vulnerable. Well, that's just stage one. How do you tactically take advantage of that? So again, that's just a matter of, you know, you've evened the odds to you have some chance of defeating it. It's not like M. Night Shyamalan Aliens where, you know, you just throw a glass of water on them.
And then they all flee. Yeah, our good old friend, the Spearfinger, you've got literally a 50-50 shot because you don't know which. I mean, she's playing three-card Monty with you. So it's like, where does she hide her heart? Left hand? Oh. And while you're in your sort of Vizini-esque stupor, she bites you, I assume, or stones you or does something awful.
Right. Also, there are special means of dispatch that just get you a little ways to overcoming the creature. Your hopping vampire, you can stick the paper incantation on its forehead and stop it. But if you've seen hopping vampire movies, you know, weirdly enough, those come off fairly readily. They don't even stick on as good as a post-it note. So Throwing roasted soybeans at the Oni, that just gets him to go away a little. That doesn't kill him off. So you may sort of have a strategic thing that there's the classic, you know, circle of salt that keeps the ghosts out if you're just, you know, trying to defend yourself. Well, again, something usually happens to the circle of salt. So there's all sorts of possibilities for a way that your special means of dispatch could go wrong. Your silver could be insufficiently pure. You got to assay your bullets before you fire them at a werewolf.
Yeah, there is, I think, at least one story where someone melts down the money to make a silver bullet to shoot at the werewolf. And then someone says, you idiot, money hasn't had silver in it since the 20s. And they wind up being mauled. Justifiably.
Yeah, it's where tigers who are allergic to nickel.
Right. Yeah, that's a whole different thing. Or the, you know, famous Rakshasa in the F-20 world and in no other world is vulnerable only to a blessed crossbow bolt. Well, did the guy actually bless it or did he just say, oh, these guys are going to go after the Rakshasa. I'll send my friends to pick through their belongings after I phonily bless their crossbow bolt. You know,
it's very medievally accurate to have a whole range of counterfeit relics.
Yeah.
So buying your holy relic that will give you an advantage against the creature is not a guarantee at all. You have to really research that thing and make sure it's actually a true relic or possibly a false relic that has been imbued with worship for enough time, has the functional equivalent. Or, you know, there's the whole question of, is it in the eye of the creature? What is it allergic to, right? Is a Hindu vampire concerned with your cross, or is there some sort of underlying thing? So you've got to really research even your legendary monsters and the new ones who are newly emergent coming across from the outer dark and looking at human culture and adopting new things, right? If you've got some sort of demon that lives in the hard drive and feeds on people's browser histories, well, is McAfee enough to kill it, or are you going to need something different?
Or do you have to go to a really toxic website to kill it, and then that's in your browser history, and problem ensues then?
Yes, it just leads you to a whole other internet demon.
Right.
So there's all sorts of ways that you can make the discovery of the special means of dispatch either make it the mystery, and then the battle with the monster is sort of an afterthought, or it's just step one in defeating the creature, or just, you know, even allows you to show up to play.
And I guess the other possibility is if the special means of dispatch could kill you, like the monster in the shunned house. Turns out dumping sulfuric acid on it kills it, but dumping sulfuric acid on anyone kills them, including player characters. Frankensteins get killed by fire. Great, we're going to set the building on fire. Oh, right, now we're in a burning building, and we don't have alchemical strength, so that may not have been the best plan we've ever had in our lives.
Yes, your napalm may be indiscriminate.
Exactly.
Well, one thing that we're discriminant about is the length of our segment. So having dispatched this question in a number of special ways, let's go and answer a different question. ...1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase. The puppet stage, the fun hats, the different mustaches that we can apply with spirit gum to ourselves or others tell us that we're backstage at the Stock Character Hut, that hut where we examine a most often Game Master character and how you can take these staples of film and theater and turn them into gaming possibilities. And today, our stock character is the guy we told about our concerns that the Stock Character Hut was seeming a little samey-samey, but he says, no, you've got it, guys, you're super. It's the Confidant. And the Confidant, of course, is, you know, all the way back to the Roman comedies where they would have the slave that they would tell their problems to, and then he would go try to solve it and ruin it usually. So by Shakespeare time, your confidant might still be a servant, like the nurse in Romeo and Juliet, who also ruins things, or your best friend. Horatio in Hamlet is the classic confidant. Hamlet says, here's what I'm going to do, Horatio. And Horatio says, can I help? It's like, nope, play's not called Horatio. You just stand around and listen to me soliloquize. And Horatio says, I don't think that's what a soliloquy is. And Hamlet says, can't talk, gotta go to England. And then obviously that best friend character expands as we have fewer and fewer cross-class friendships in movies and film and literature and plays. So Sam in Casablanca, although technically an employee of Rick, is obviously really a best friend. Foggy Nelson is technically, I think, Daredevil's boss, but he's still the confidant there. And I guess the other example that you give us, Robin, is the confidant who is the guy who tells you that you're being bad and wrong, your conscience, if you will, your Jiminy Cricket.
Your Jiminy Cricket. And so the advantage of having a confidant character, particularly in a dramatic form like a stage play or a film, as opposed to a work of fiction where you can just present the hero's internal monologue on the page, is that gives you a device that allows the audience to understand what the main character is thinking. And so often they'll either be revealing their plans, like Hamlet. Hamlet does a bunch of weird stuff, and he does have the option of giving internal monologue, soliloquy, but also he discusses stuff with Horatio. And there's also a contrast with Horatio in that Hamlet is the one doing extreme things, and Horatio is, spoiler, the one who lives at the end. Whereas Sam and Casablanca, his role is to push Bogey very subtly toward the direction that we want him to be pushed, which is to open up his heart again, but also to do the right thing, because his arc is one of going from selfishness back to the altruism that he once used to embody. And so another area where people talk about both their plans and their feelings is the rom-com. The Confidant is an absolute staple of that genre. So, for example, When Harry Met Sally has a double confidant. There's one for the male lead. There's one for the female lead. So Bruno Kirby is the Billy Crystal character's best friend. Carrie Fisher gives advice to Meg Ryan. And they are both there to allow the main characters to talk about their love problems and why they're not getting together with the object of their affection that we've been set up to want them to get with. There's a funny example in the film Trainwreck where the confidant to the male character is LeBron James playing himself, which is very funny. And that has another confidant for the Amy Schumer character, for Vanessa Beer plays that character.
And then throughout the 90s and the 2000s, Jeremy Piven and Joan Cusack made, I assume, very successful and lucrative careers out of being the best friend in various films. Sometimes Jeremy Piven will be the best friend in a crime movie a little bit, so change up a little bit. But often in your rom-com, who's your buddy? He's Jeremy Piven. And often Jeremy Piven would be sort of the bad example. He's sort of the little devil on your shoulder. You tell him about your true love and he says, no, let's go run around and get drunk and live for today and not think about romance. And so sort of the opposite of Jiminy Cricket is the confidant who's a bit of a foil for you, maybe a little more of a Mercutio, to go back to Shakespeare, than a Horatio.
Right. The Vince Vaughn character in Swingers is another one of those.
Yeah.
And Jeremy Piven and Joan Cusack are both in Grosse Pointe Blank, both playing those characters. A subtype of the confidant from the rom-com is the gay best friend, a trope that some people find tiresome, but the sort of epical version of that is Rupert Everett in My Best Friend's Wedding. Also military films, it's sort of a natural situation where the commanding officer has a trusted, often older fellow officer who they bounce ideas off of and talk about situations. That's another thing where strategy will often come into play in a film. And so you will want one character, well, are you sure that's wise? Well, here, we're going to go over this hill. So you've got, neither of these is exactly that, but William Powell, who plays Doc in Mr. Roberts, fills that role. He's sort of a more avuncular version of the character. Or Goose, Anthony Edwards in Top Gun is that.
Yeah, there's an element to which, I mean, we've talked about Alfred before in the stock character hut, but Alfred being a character that is now, what, 80 years old? I feel like Alfred is also sometimes the confidant in the trusted servant vibe, so that Batman can explain his plans and sometimes be talked down and sometimes be talked back in, depending on which
Batman. Yeah, the Michael Caine one is absolutely fills that role.
Right.
In Vertigo, there's an interesting case, speaking of tropes crossing over and combining, Barbara Bel Geddes, who plays Midge in Vertigo, she's both the confidant and a female Ralph Bellamy. She's two of those things in one. So she's trying to talk sense into Jimmy Stewart. There's also an interesting break that can sometimes occur in some narratives where there's a break with the confidant and that signals the protagonist's tragic spiral. So you've got that in Macbeth with Banquo, who goes from confidant to enemy to, spoilers, ghost. There's the Joseph Cotten character in Citizen Kane has exactly that arc. And in Double Indemnity, the Edward G. Robinson character goes from confidant to nemesis. And so that's a great sort of contrasting arc to the main character's arc as played by Fred McMurray. There are other adjacent things that you can confuse with the confidant. So there's the buddy. And the thing that I think is different there is that there's unclear who is the protagonist and who is the supporting character. So, for example, in the Ocean's movies, Clooney and Pitt, they differ insofar as one is extremely handsome and charismatic and smart, and the other is very handsome and charismatic and smart. So it's not, you know, Danny Ocean's name is in the name of the movie, but they're buddies. Pitt is not particularly a more of a confidant to Clooney than vice versa. There's the trainee and the mentor. We're going to have to get back to the mentor character at some point in this segment, but I think that's a different enough pattern that that's not really the confidant. However, often the confidant will be portrayed as a the mentor who trained up the main character, but the training sequence bit has happened in the backstory, and now they're more of a grizzled advisor. So the Kris Kristofferson character in Blade fits that pattern.
And then the other thing that is aligned with the confidant is the sidekick. Again, the differential there is that the sidekick is often the person you're training or the person who doesn't take part in the main story. So in that way, very similar to Horatio, but they're clearly not the equal in terms of story weight, in no other sense, the main character. So in some Sherlock Holmeses, Holmes and Watson are more confidants, the way that Doyle began writing the character. Then Doyle got lazy, and so do Sherlock Holmes creators since him, and you get a Watson who's just a sidekick and just exists to be shoved around and have the story told to them later. And that's your sort of Batman and Robin, Superman and Jimmy Olsen, where although they are genuinely friends, it is clear that one of them is Batman and one of them is not Batman.
Right. And the test is, does the main one confide in the other? So, for example, in Rio Bravo, which Howard Hawks created in order to show that a real hero doesn't really need friends. Well, he kind of does, but he's still strong on his own. It's the sidekick played by Dean Martin who requires to be healed by the presence of the main character, not the other way around. So he's not someone that the Duke doesn't have to confide in anybody. He has people who gather around him. So the gaming application of the confidant first came up in my designs when I came to design Gumshoe One-to-One for Cthulhu Confidential, because that's a situation where not only do you need to have other characters that the main character can go to for their specialist skills, because unless you're doing Sherlock Holmes, you don't always want to have a completely omnicompetent character. So if your LA private detective needs to know something about geology, he goes to his science professor friend. That, however, turned out to have a even bigger reason to exist in a one GM, one player setup, which is that is very tense for the player. And having a bunch of characters that they can go and talk to and just have a safe scene where they don't have to worry about interrogating anybody, and they're going to, you know, the character's going to just give them a coffee and it's going to be a little relaxed. It's not comic relief, but it is still relief. It's a sense of pause and a relief of suspense and tension. And so when it came to design Page Turners, which is my upcoming game of one player, one GM dramatic interaction, I realized that that had to carry over into that, because just as you don't want to be, you know, talking to gangsters and cultists every single scene, in a dramatic scene where most of the other characters are putting you under pressure or you are trying to press them, they're needs to be a scene where you can just go and bat some ideas off someone who's fundamentally sympathetic. Maybe they'll be a bit of a conscience and sort of gently Jiminy Cricket you a bit, but mostly that sort of provides a break. So in my sort of example scenario, The Beacon, which is sort of an F. Scott Fitzgerald pastiche, you have a choice as player as to what character you select as your confidant. You don't get to select any characters you're confident, because often that would eliminate, for example, your main antagonist. But so for this one, there's like a drunken observer named Abbot Conant, who's comes from a wealthy background and is a hanger-on at the parties of the sort of major game master character. He might be played by Zachary Scott or perhaps even William Powell. Or you have a real life character you can have as your confidant, Dorothy Parker. Oddly, most people who play it pick Abbot Conant. I think they're still a little intimidated by Dorothy Parker.
I think that the real life record of having Dorothy Parker as your confidant is not great.
Right. But she would have good insights. And the bargain is that she will be nice to you, right? She won't squeeze you too much. In Sarah Sam Saltiel's Addison's Shadow, which is about growing up in a house with conflict between your mom and dad, and also there's a shadowy entity, you can pick either your younger brother or your best friend as the confidant. There's a space station one where you're the last humans on a spaceship. You can pick sort of your morale boosting father figure. He's sort of your past mentor kind of, or you can pick the captain of the crew. In Ruth Tillman's Jane Austen pastiche, Entreaty and Entanglement, you pick your younger sister as your obvious confidant. Wade Rocket has done several things. One of them is Loose Screws, which is a screwball comedy. So you can pick your favorite sanatorium employee. You can pick a nurse or an orderly. In my Shakespearean comedy one, Love's Loyal Laborers, you pick the other possible player character as your confidant. So the premise there is that you are two wily servants and you are trying to get your two masters to marry one another so that you can live together in the same household. So the romantic lead, who is a game master character, if you're her servant, you're the female part of the pair. Otherwise, your master is a guy and you're a guy. But the other character, the one you're in love with, serves as your confidant because you're both working toward the same end. In Wade's True Rock Stories, which is basically a behind the music sort of music docudrama, you can play either a scenester or a band member. And in Sam's Without You, which is a drama about a vampire trying to convince his dying lover to be turned, but she doesn't want to do it. She'd rather die. And that one, again, you pick your confidant based on which character you've chosen to pick. So if you're playing the vampire, your sort of weary sire reluctantly puts up with your request for advice. Or in the case of if you're playing the human character, the fellow patient is your confidant. And so in all of those cases, that gives you a break from the tough, heavy-duty petitioner-granter thing where you know if you go to your confidant for advice, you're going to get it. And it's a chance to sort of bounce ideas off the GM and character, get a little bit of insight, but also a rest. The challenging thing from the GM's point of view is to actually play it in a more laid-back way and not press them, which is something I caught myself doing, putting on too much pressure as a confidant and had to dial those scenes back.
So in a more standard game session, your fellow player characters may be your confidants, although one hopes it's more of a Ocean's 11 situation where you're all equals in a crew. Does the GMC confidant, does that have a role to play in a game where you can easily bounce things off someone else and do all the other dramatic necessities and there isn't the stress and pressure of a one-to-one situation, Robin?
Yeah, I think that's something that we all probably do because, for example, let's say, you know, you are a group of fantasy characters and it's castle intrigue and there's all sorts of backstabbers all about, but you know that you can go to, you know, the castellan and he's an old family friend and he can kind of give you the lay of the land and give you information. And so you can go to talk to somebody who you're pretty sure is not going to backstab you. And so particularly if you're moving into a new situation where there's a bunch of characters, even in Vampire, I would think that in amongst all the intrigue that there are times when it's like, do we have a friend?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can buy a friend with points in Vampire. Yeah. So that's the important thing to keep in mind.
Yeah. So exactly. It's important enough that you can pay for it and it's a special power. It's having a friend is a crunchy bit.
Right. Well, once we've started paying for our friends, parentheses derogatory, it's time probably to listen to our confidants' shushing tones and disappointed look and move into a different segment where surely there will be no disappointed looks or shushing tones.
In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
and must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Keep this podcast away from the amulet that kills it by joining such beloved Patreon backers as...
Yadge from Edinburgh.
Drew Eichels.
Manfred Gabriel.
Liz Ann Siski.
And Robbie Carlton. It's time once more to head on through the lobby, grab our popcorn, and head on down to our favorite seats in the plush cinema and sit back for another installment of the Cinema Hut. And this time around, we're continuing our Fantasy Film Essentials series. And after a beginning of the 80s that I was a little concerned about, we are back on our feet again with some solid entries that I can wholeheartedly recommend and that you want me to wholeheartedly recommend. And one that I think some people were afraid that I would not recommend, but I'm very happy to do so, is Labyrinth from 1986, directed by Jim Henson. The screenplay is by Terry Jones, based on a story by Henson and by Henson's collaborator on Fraggle Rock, the Canadian poet and author of classic children's poems as well, Dennis Lee. It is a very 80s looking and very Henson-ish in his folklore and mythology side of what he was doing. It's the classic changeling story, but it happens to a girl who's babysitting, the worst possible way for a child to be stolen by goblins. So young Sarah, played by Jennifer Connelly, in a case of early great casting, winds up being drawn into the realm of fairy by the simultaneously terrifying yet also strangely charming and magnetic Jareth, played by David Bowie. I think Labyrinth is particularly important to a lot of young girls who saw it at a particular age, and they had some formative feelings, perhaps, about David Bowie. But we didn't mention Dark Crystal, but this time the puppets are more expressive, and they're not the human-like characters, and the whole presentation, I think, builds on what Dark Crystal got sort of right and delivers what in fact is a classic fantasy film.
And if people are coming to this to listen to me diss Labyrinth, they are coming to the wrong podcast. I loved Labyrinth when I saw it in the theater. I have loved Labyrinth every time I've seen it. It is the ideal fairy tale combination of sweetness and acid that every great fairy tale has, and it has those in equal measure. The titular Labyrinth is genuinely fantastic. You have no idea what's going to come next. It is both, as you say, strangely compelling, but also clearly horribly dangerous in exactly the way that you want your fairies to be. David Bowie, you know, remarkable presence, but also I think does more acting in this than people give him credit for, that it's not just let's put David Bowie in a cool wig and take pictures of David Bowie. I think he really brings a lot of the sort of ambivalence of being drawn into another world, perhaps something that he has had lived with for 20 years by the time they make this film. So yeah, it works on all the levels on the surface, and then it keeps working down below. There is no part of this movie, puppets notwithstanding, that seems artificial. It all seems very real and also utterly fantastic, which is the best thing you can say about a fantasy movie.
And now you're going to tell us a bit about a story of the fantastic told by one of cinema's greatest grandpas.
Exactly. This, as though we needed to plug it anymore, is The Princess Bride from 1987, directed by the Rob Reiner at the absolute height of his and perhaps anyone's powers. The key to The Princess Bride begins with the script, which is by the great William Goldman, one of the great script writers in Hollywood, based on his novel, which is one of the great fantasy, sort of meta-fantasy, ironic fantasy novels of all time. But despite it being a ironic book, it becomes a very sweet and beautiful movie. The Mark Knopfler score does a lot of heavy lifting in that direction. And of course, the casting is legendarily perfect, all the way from Cary Elwes as Wesley, Robin Wright as the princess, all the way down to the completely side characters, Billy Crystal as Miracle Max, Carol Kane as his beloved wife, and of course, Christopher Guest as one of the villain, and Chris Sarandon as the even worse villain, Prince Humperdinck. The sweetness and the power of Andre the Giant as Physique sort of, it turns out to be the anchor of the film. Everything sort of rotates around that. But again, as you imply, it's told by someone even more sweet and wonderful than Andre the Giant, Peter Falk as the granddad. There is no part of this movie that does not work. It may be the most flawless film that we're going to list. It is not quite the absolute heights of fantasy that some of our other choices have been, but I think it is a movie with no flaws, and that alone would make it an essential. And it is certainly one that you can watch, by my count, dozens of times and never get remotely tired of or remotely insensitive to. It hits every note. It hits it perfectly.
The cast of characters and actors is so stacked that you can't help but leave a major one out. So let's mention Mandy Patinkin.
Yes.
As Inigo Montoya, one of the great archetypal swashbucklers of all time, has the most quotable line.
And real choreography for the sword fight. They did not have to do that, but they did it. And it's an amazingly great sword fight. In the list of great sword fights, this is one of the great sword fights. If we did the sword fight essentials, this would still be there. Yeah.
We haven't even mentioned Wallace Shawn and Andrew the Giant. I saw this in its first run in a packed theater in Toronto, and so it was a surprise to me to learn that this was a theatrical flop on its initial release. It is one of those films that has become an integral part of the canon and the fantasy canon to fantasy fans, but outside of big cities, people didn't know what to make of it because it was a whole new thing.
And I think that meta tone that I talked about may have thrown some people off back in the 80s when our fantasy came with big swords and dumb blondes.
Yes, it took people a while to figure out what it was and to clasp it to their bosoms. Speaking of Peter Falk, another film with Peter Falk in it, Wings of Desire from 1987 by Wim Wenders, the German director. This is a film about angels who watch over the sad people of Berlin and sometimes come up to them and whisper into their ears and give them solace. So these are not punishing angels, they're healing angels. But Bruno Ganz, as Damiel, yearns for something more. He yearns for humanity, and he yearns in particular for Solveig Damartin, who plays Marion, the trapeze artist who he is enamored with. And so in this very dreamlike extended film, he experiments with the nature of humanity. The black and white footage, which is most of the film, is from the point of view of the angels, but things seen from the human point of view or while human are in brilliant color. So there's two contrasting, beautiful styles of cinematography. Peter Falk shows up as a confidant and as himself. He's shooting a film in town. He's Peter Falk, but he can sense the presence of angels because, like we said, Peter Falk. And so he has a conversation in a currywurst shop with Bruno Ganz's angel. Wenders films, he's very inspired by Ozu, and they're quite often trying to reach a transcendental feeling through the kind of breaking the rules of narrative, being very gentle, very observational. Sometimes it doesn't work at all. Wings of Desire feels a little long when you're watching it, but is one of those films that feels long while you're watching it, but then is indelible when you think back on it later, as opposed to other films that feel long when you think about it and feel even longer when you look back on them. So it's another staple film of the world cinema canon and undoubtedly a great fantasy film as well.
Yeah, I watched this on cable when it came out, and I remember it being beautiful, as you say, just beautiful and dreamlike. This is before I'd seen Carl Dreyer's Vampire. This is before I'd seen half the beautiful dreamlike canon or virtually any of it. So it was like nothing else that was ever on HBO in my experience. And I do remember it feeling long, certainly, which is part of why I have not revisited it, despite its very great reputation. And despite the fact that I am now a somewhat more savvy film consumer than I was at age 22 when this came out. Speaking of films, in this case, fantasy films for grown-ups, let's talk about The Witches of Eastwick, directed by the great George Miller, based on the John Updike novel, the only John Updike novel that I have successfully finished, because it had witches in. This is, I think, John Updike trying to do grown-up Roald Dahl, but fortunately the film hero, played by Jack Nicholson, is similarly deserving of his fate, but is actually an active participant in it, as opposed to the Updike hero. And his fate is to be loved and then entrapped by the witches, Cher, Susan Sarandon, and Michelle Pfeiffer, which is quite the lineup in 1987 or in any year. And it is, I think the movie really triumphs in doing that sort of, this is an adult fantasy in that it has adult concerns and is about adult kinds of danger and is not something that I think kids will ever particularly pay attention to or go along with, despite the presence of witches. But it is almost, you could almost tip it over into a horror film in the way that the our protagonist goes to his fate. What do you think, Robin?
Right. Right. And of course, he's the devil.
Yeah.
His name is Daryl Van Horn. Can't leave that part out. So it's the witches summon a devil and he thinks he's got the upper hand over his witches and he doesn't. This is one of the sort of great post-Shining Nicholson performances where he's turning the Nicholson up to 11 and he's splendidly funny in the role. His sort of unraveling is great fun. It's in the tradition of the folk devil who is undone. And it's, as you suggest, it departs considerably from the Updike novel. The tone is a George Miller tone, not an Updike tone, but a big budget, star-filled movie that just delivers and is fun and it fires in all cylinders. And the ending in the church really pays off. And now a legendary production, Ken, that you're going to tell us about.
Yes, this is legendarily fraught because Terry Gilliam, this is, I think, maybe the first of his legendarily fraught productions. I guess Brazil was pretty fraught too. This is 1988's Adventures of Baron Munchausen. And we've talked about Munchausen all the way back as one of the early wellsprings of fantasy. Gilliam would rather, I think, go back to those than do a regular fantasy movie ever. And so that's what he does. And once more, we have Gilliam's sense of what I want to say, not quite insanity, but certainly a sort of a off-kilter universe that is badly overlaid. And that's the point onto ours. And Baron Munchausen, John Neville is the sort of interface between those universes. So once more, we have a fantasy movie about the importance of fantasy, but because Gilliam and because of the pretty stacked rest of the cast, it does not come off as twee. It comes off as actually a little bit scary and urgent. And the forces of mundanity that would shackle and destroy Baron Munchausen are always present, even when the film is being sweet and funny, which it mostly is. And again, Eric Idle is his one of his multi-talented sidekicks. Oliver Reed is the god Vulcan, which is terrific. This is, I believe, either Uma Thurman's screen debut or one of them. But I remember when she rises up out of the ocean as Venus, my friend Ingrid said half the theater inhaled at once when that happened.
Yeah, she's in a clamshell in the classic pose.
In the classic Botticelli pose. And again, it is a real tribute to Gilliam that he can rip off Botticelli and make it worth doing and make there be a point to it. It's a really remarkable film visually, along with all of its other great characteristics. And I still love it. I still enjoy it. I saw it in the theater in 88 when it came out and have returned to it every now and again whenever I sort of remember, oh, right, I own this on Blu-ray. I should watch it again.
John Neville is great as Munchausen. He was a English actor who came over to Canada for a while to our Stratford Festival and became a staple here. Sarah Polley, future auteur, is Sally Salt, the child protagonist, and was famously terrified on set of the actual dangers that she was being placed in.
Yes.
Eric Idle is still angry about the shoot of this film years later. So the terror you speak of was felt by members of the cast. Yeah.
That's one way to get it out on the screen, I guess.
Yeah. An uncredited Robin Williams is fabulous as the king of the moon.
The man in the moon. Yep.
Head comes off and at that point, he was sufficiently struggling as an actor that his agents told him not to accept credit because they were afraid that this would sink his career permanently. Of course, he went on to other things after this. And whatever agreement there was to not credit him was ignored somewhat when the trailer was cut, because he's all over the trailer as mm-hmm. Eric Idle. And I think it plays better on second viewings as well, because there are some ragged bits that kind of reflect the difficulties of the production. But once you're not looking for those, the individual episodic moments really score. So this is going to be the last in our Fantasy Essentials series for a little bit.
Because fantasy film ends in the 80s.
No.
And there are no good fantasy films after that.
It's just a hiatus. We've got some special programming coming up. So we'll be back with to continue the series in episode 670, which will drop on October 10th. But we're not done with this podcast. So let's see what other segment waits us on the other side. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is now fully available in print as well as PDF.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
The bubbling of beakers, the retorting of retorts, and the burning of the Bunsen burner cells were once more going to have fun with science, because beloved patron backer Alan Wilkins asks, might sterile neutrinos be the dreaded elliptons? Now, Ken, it was recently pointed out to me that we record every episode with the assumption that everyone has already heard 300 episodes. And so some of the things that we talk about apparently need some introduction in case you are listening to this for the very first time. And so weirdly, in what is not the Elliptony Hut, I'm going to need you to start out by explaining what we think Elliptony is. And then we'll get into the actual science.
All right. Elliptony is my general term for the entire universe of Fortiana, the occult, conspiracy theory, ancient astronauts, Kennedy conspiracies, fairies, magic, UFOs, all of the good stuff. All that stuff that finds its own shelves in the bookstore but doesn't have a name. The name is Elliptony. It's a field of science. Is it social science? Is it physical science? Is it biological science? Is it all of them? Mothman? Who can say? And this takes its name from the once radically communist, then radically nationalist Russian parliamentarian Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who during the contretemps over the fall of the Berlin Wall said that the Americans should not get too stroppy because Russia had the feared Ellipton weapon and would unleash the Ellipton. The power of the Ellipton would be unleashed against the West if they tried anything. And he repeated these threats during the Bosnia crisis and every so often during his long and eventful life. And eventually he was called back to his infernal master. But the Ellipton struck me as the perfect particle of all of this stuff, because Vladimir Zhirinovsky was a believer in the occult. He was a believer in and machinator of conspiracy theories. It's obviously pretend physics. So it's already everything. So the field of Elliptony became the field of stuff made up of or radiated by elliptons, hence the name. Elliptonics, by the way, is the applied field. If you're building something to control a UFO or talk to Bigfoot, that would be an electronic machine. We don't use that term as much because University of Chicago, we believe in the theory first. That is Elliptony. Robin?
Right. Now, having dispensed with the nonsense, it's time for some actual science.
Yes.
Because of the particles, the possible existence of a sterile neutrino is as close to a weird mystery while also being science as you can get. So, Ken, it's time for you to introduce some heavy-duty weird concepts of all the tiny little bits and bobs that we are made up of.
Yes. This segment is now two humanities nerds discuss particle physics. So get ready. The sterile neutrino was theorized by a Japanese physicist named Tsutomu Yamagita in 1979. He came up with a way that the Big Bang could have created a bunch of particles. And the problem when you look at the Big Bang is, why did our universe come out instead of all kind of other universes? And that's the big question that particle physics struggles with, because there's no reason, unless you say God did it, which is considered cheating. So his thesis is that leptons, which are the category of tiny particles.
Sounds suspiciously like elliptons.
It does. And they formed asymmetrically in terms of mass. Charges have to be balanced to make all the math work. So protons are positive, electrons are negative. We move forward. That goes down to the tiniest of particles, your quarks and your baryons and whatnot. But leptons don't have to be the same mass. So a proton is really big and an electron is really small. His question is, what if during the Big Bang, the amount of mass was constant, but was drawn into one kind of particle and not the other kinds? And so since we know that neutrinos are tiny and nearly massless, his theory is, what if there's big, heavy neutrinos that we just haven't seen because they do not interact with the weak nuclear force, which is how we detect neutrinos in the first place. Instead, they can only be affected by gravity, which is super hard to do a lab for since we don't have anti-gravity. So that's his thesis, named the seesaw mechanism. He called it that in a talk in 81. And the reason he picked on the neutrino is that every other subatomic particle has both left and right hand chirality or spin. Neutrinos, the ones we've detected, only have left hand chirality, which means that the right hand neutrinos could be just missing. And therefore, they would be the sterile ones. And they're, if Yamagita's theory is correct, they're heavier than active neutrinos. And so masses of heavy neutrinos are called neutral heavy leptons, NHLs. Also, sometimes they're called HNLs, but that doesn't cause hockey confusion, so I prefer NHLs. So the thesis now is, if we have this big missing mass that we can't find, maybe that's dark matter. Even under the most generous assumptions, you can't get enough sterile neutrinos to make up dark matter, but maybe they're also part of dark radiation. And also, if Yamagita is correct, it explains baryogenesis, which is why baryons were created at the beginning of time instead of anti-baryons. So basically, why is the universe not made of antimatter and blow everything up all the time? The answer is because at the beginning of time, all these sterile neutrinos blooped up all the mass and banged into enough antimatter that they shifted the balance in the first microseconds of the Big Bang. So we have this great theory. It explains a mystery of science. So far, so good. However, they have been attempting to experimentally find NHLs since the 90s, or I guess since the 80s, really, since they started this stuff. And they've got a bunch of different answers. So the 1993 to 1998, the LSND detector at Los Alamos found an anomaly, but seemingly ruled out NHLs. So it's like there's a whole nother
anomaly. They did not get the anomaly they were looking for.
In 2001, neutrino measurement experiments at Fermilab in CERN found nothing above a certain mass. So they've sort of set an upper boundary for how heavy the neutral heavy lepton can be. Mini Boon, which is a neutrino experiment at Fermilab here in the Chicagoland area, reported no NHLs in 2007, but stronger neutrino oscillation than expected in 2018. So that's good news. But then in 2021, no sign again. So they're going back and forth at Fermilab. There's a neutrino detector at Daya Bay in China, down near Shenzhen. They reported missing antineutrinos in 2012, which would imply, again, that this big neutrino has been blowing them up. But again, they theoretically ruled out the NHL based on their observations. Planck satellite 2013 data looking for neutrinos in space says that we can't rule it out, but they didn't find one. The Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory, which I think exists to explain what the kids are talking about to other observatories, it's at the South Pole, and it found no NHLs in 2016. Neutrino 4, it's an experimental team in St. Petersburg, Russia, claimed in 2020 to have isolated mathematically the sterile neutrino, that they've bracketed these observations and said the sterile neutrino is here. They say that it creates about 5% of the energy of the universe and about 15 to 27% of the dark matter. And then they wouldn't release their data. And so everyone piled on them and said that they were liars and Russians. And so the stereo experiment in Grenoble, they published their results in 2023. They ruled out light sterile neutrinos, but not heavy ones. So we are getting down to one that is somewhere, and I will have this wrong, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of two or three electron masses, I think, is the amount that a which is huge for a neutrino, by the way. And so that's what they're beginning to think it has to be if it's that size. So the last great hope for sterile neutrinos is a Robert Ludlum title of a phenomenon called the gallium anomaly. And the gallium anomaly is that when you set up a big pool of liquid gallium to detect neutrinos, because the neutrinos zip through it and they bang into the gallium atoms and they turn them from gallium into germanium-71, which is radioactive, by knocking off an electron. The results from GALAX in Italy in 1998 and SAGE, which stands for Soviet American Gallium Experiment, which is now the Russian American Gallium Experiment, but they don't call it RAGE as often. In 2005, SAGE showed a germanium-71 shortfall of around 20%, meaning that there's 20% of the radioactive germanium is missing, which implies that some number of neutrinos are not interacting with weak decay, which means they're just zipping through that tank and not turning things into radioactive germanium. So now there is an ongoing test underneath a mountain on the borders of Russia and Georgia called the BEST, the Baxon Experiment on Sterile Transitions. They have kept running things through increasingly large tanks of gallium to try and make it work. They have not yet come up with an explanation. And so far, the Russian government has not sold off their 57 tons of liquid gallium to fund their war. So I guess good for you, the Russian science establishment. Big one cheer, big question mark. But, you know, the liquid gallium is still there, not turning into enough germanium, which is, as we say, the best case scenario for finding NHLs, a.k.a. sterile neutrinos, a.k.a. the ellipton, question mark.
Right. So if they are elliptons, we would expect one of two things. Either elliptons generate elliptonic events, or elliptonic events generate elliptons. And so the question there is, instead of trying to look directly into the neutrinos, is to look for the ripple effect. And so if we look at the labs that we can get the best information about, the question is, are they associated with elliptonic events? Of course, elliptons, like a lot of subatomic particles, time doesn't mean a lot to them. They go backwards and forwards in time. And so things even from earlier, like from the 1940s, would be generated by attempts to measure NHLs now. And so you can definitely see that, for example, at Los Alamos, because between 48 and 49, there was a green fireballs flap of green anomalies in the skies. Were they UFOs? Were they something else? Were they elliptons being given off? We don't know. The labs at Los Alamos are haunted. They've had repeated ghost sightings over the years, including a shapely female ghost. The nearby Jemez Mountains has the Mogollon Monster, which is slightly less cool when you realize it's a local name for a Bigfoot or Sasquatch. But there's also a blue light in nearby canyons, which is claimed both by UFO enthusiasts and by cryptid followers as possibly their thing. We don't have to resolve in this segment whether the blue light is a UFO or a cryptid, or in fact, again, another ellipton emanation, in order to look at this as proof that yes, indeed, just the attempt to find NHLs generates elliptonic events. Now, is it just Los Alamos? No, Fermilab is considered one of the most haunted labs in the United States, which I didn't even know was a listicle until today. So they've experienced eerie sounds, cold spots, ghostly scientists, And what more evidence do we need that performing neutrino experiments generates leptons than that? Well, how about the 2023 triangular UFO that flew slow and low over Fermilab and was seen by multiple people? Or just the fact that the surrounding area of Batavia, Illinois, has the Big Muddy Monster. And of course, there are Mothman sightings in the area as well. What about CERN? Well, it has had more sort of esoterrorist sort of style activities. There's been a viral dimensional portal video that has been gone the rounds. It seems like CGI, not a breach of the membrane into the outer dark, but that's what they would want you to think. The researchers there, as in fact in all of these places, refer to unexplained particles as ghosts. So if neutrinos are ghosts, right there, elliptons. And there was also another hoax, a 2016 cult ritual outside of CERN that made the video rounds. What about Galax in the Swiss-Italian border? The Gran Sasso region has had a 1978 anomaly flap where they had electrical disturbances, spontaneously boiling water, radar blips, orange lights. Again, this has to be a lepton after effect, ripple effect. And it's the region is home to the Pendefeche, which is a dread entity that manifests during a sleep paralysis. We don't have the witnesses for the South Pole. Obviously, authoritarian governments in China and Russia are not going to release their leptonic sightings to the West.
Although Mount Elbrus, which is basically the big mountain that Mount Andreeche, that the BEST laboratory is under, did have UFO sightings in 1968, and of course is famously home to both the ALMA, a cryptid similar to the Yeti, and mammoths get seen there. So out of place or out of time mammoths. And it was one of the mystic gates to heaven and might have been the rock that Prometheus was chained to. So it's connected to myth and legend as well.
So since this is from the science, we can conclude that yes, absolutely. It may or may not be that the sterile neutrino is the lepton, but looking for the sterile neutrino generates leptons, or perhaps sucks the leptons out of the surrounding area and moves them off to where anomalous events can occur. But I have to say that the evidence is suggesting, and I haven't finished up the preprint yet, but I think we've conclusively proven that.
Yeah, I think that we've definitely established a theoretical range within which leptons can be detected. And that range, at the very least, includes looking for sterile neutrinos. So well done, us. Once more, humanities beats particle physics. Yay, us. And also, once more, a triumphant sighting of a Yeti-like monster closes out this episode of our beloved podcast. But don't worry, in a week, we'll be back with similar monsters, or perhaps even worse ones.
Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast neutrinos fecund by joining such backers as
James Candelino,
Jesse Lowe,
Andrea Coletta,
Darren Hennessy,
and Derek McMullen.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, Subtlety is for People Who Forgot Their Battering Ram.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.